Okay, now our speaker for today is Glenn. I've known Glenn, you know, for several years, and you know, I know him as a really hard worker and a really nice guy. So I want to call, and his birthday is this month, so I want to call Glenn to come on up.
Hey, you know, they say we're not saints, but some of us are Saints fans, right? Who that? Just in, right. Anyway, my name is Glenn Calvert. I'm an alcoholic. I was given the gift of sobriety December 13th, 1986, and I've been kept sober by a merciful and loving higher power and by the program and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous since that day. And that is a miracle on the order of loaves and fish for a big shot know-it-all drunk like me. So, like, wow. And it's not my fault. I didn't try. It just, you know, that's what I'd say. It's a miracle. I also think, like, you know, we kind of take it for granted. But if you think about it, our AA big book is sort of a miracle, right? It was written by a guy who had no business writing it. I mean, Bill was sober, what, 3 years? And he had more sobriety than anybody else. And, you know, he writes a treatise on alcoholism. To this day, I've not found anything that explains alcoholism better than our big book. And then he proceeds to tell us that the solution is a spiritual awakening. Bill was a washout agnostic. I mean, he wasn't even a good agnostic, you know. I mean, you got to have a lot of torque on your agnosticism and atheism if you're going to do that. He wasn't even that good about it. I think secretly he was just kind of, you know, mad that he thought that God probably had his job, you know, like running the universe or something. But he writes a book like this, and it's an amazing thing. And you know, there was like 180 people, depending on who you ask at the time. They had to agree on everything up to the 12 steps, up to chapter 5. You ever try to go to lunch with a bunch of alcoholics? That's like a fist fight right there, you know? And he got these people to agree upon it. It's an amazing thing. You know, it's beyond words. And just the way it was written, I truly believe the book was divinely inspired. That's my opinion. You know, there are other people who agree with that. Some maybe not so. Anyway, I got to tell you, man, I did not get sober because I'm smart or virtuous. It was truly a matter of circumstances and just miracle after miracle that kept me in here and kept me sober. Kept me coming to meetings and kept me following directions, because that's something I really didn't do. I loved alcohol. Alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. I was 6 years old. Last night I was watching television. The Beatles came to the United States in 1964. I was in first grade. I remember that because it was on Ed Sullivan. I couldn't tell you much else. President Kennedy got shot that year. I remember that. I couldn't tell you what I got for Christmas, but I can tell you all about New Year's Day. New Year's Day, I ate too much, and my mother and father decided to give me a hot toddy, which is, you know, hot tea, bourbon, and honey. And I remember everything about that. I remember what I was wearing. I remember how my dad's chair felt. I remember what was on television. It was the Orange Bowl, and Steve Spurrier was the quarterback for the Florida Gators. I couldn't tell you the Beatles' names. I didn't know who the vice president was, but I remember everything about that night because I had a spiritual awakening thanks to alcohol. Kind of woke me up. And then also, too, I remember being really angry. My mother wouldn't give me another one. I didn't think much about it. At 11 years, I was a really scared kid. You know, I was always that kid that was, I never thought I was good enough, always kind of coming from behind. No matter what it was I was doing, I always felt like people, I never seemed to feel the way everybody else looked. Like I was a step behind, and I was 11 years old. I was at a party my parents were at, and I had a favorite aunt. She was like this big and this big, and she drank Dixie beer and ate M&Ms all day. Peanut M&Ms, not regular M&Ms. And as long as she had peanut M&Ms and Dixie beer, everything was fine. And I don't know, there was a little girl there about my age. She was ignoring me, and I went and sat by my aunt. And this will really date me, too. These were the first years that they had pop-top beer cans. And you had to use a church key before that. Some of y'all might remember Church Keys. And then I opened up one of her beers. I asked her, could I open up one of your beers? Because I hadn't opened up a pop top because it was only in beers first, sodas later. And she said, that's fine. And I opened up a beer and I gave it to her. And she goes, well, I have one. I was like, oh, well, what? She goes, it's cool. Just why don't you drink it? Okay. And man, I didn't really like the way it tasted, but it was magic. It was like the first deep breath I ever took in my life. Whew. Man, it was incredible. Like all the stuff that was going on in my head, I didn't care about it. That little girl came and sat on my lap. Yeah, that's a whole nother theme of my alcoholism. And then, I don't know, I just couldn't wait to do it again. And I kept doing it. And, you know, in the beginning, it was great. I had a really high tolerance. I never seemed to really get in trouble. And when I got in trouble, I could kind of work my way around it. I went to this all-boys Catholic high school that was very strong, athletic tradition, ROTC. And I fit in with these guys. And I actually made the varsity football team that were defending state champions as a freshman. It was the biggest thing that ever happened to me in my life. There wasn't that many of us that made it. And we made a vow July 4th that we weren't going to drink anymore because we wanted to be competitive for the season. So we were going to spend the rest of the time really seriously training. I was the first guy that got caught drinking. I don't think I lasted a week. Now, I meant it when I said it. I really meant it. I meant it as sincerely as I possibly could when I said it. And there was a girl who said, hey, have a beer. And I'm like, oh, okay. And a bunch of the guys saw me. They ratted me out. Went to captain's practice. Captain's practice was they would make you do 100-yard bear crawls on a run. The captains would hit you with weight belts and scream obscenities at you and stuff. And I was in really good shape, so the 100-yard bear crawl didn't bother me. I was kind of a twisted kid. I thought it was kind of funny. Yeah, I wasn't right. And a really bad precedent set in. I gave my word. I meant it when I said it. I couldn't live up to my word when it came to alcohol. I got consequences, but I managed the consequences. And that is probably one of the things that really contributed a lot to my alcoholism, is that I could always seem to talk my way in and out of situations. I was always real quick with the right thing to say. I could lie without thinking about it. I mean, that was unbelievable. Like wow, I can't even, where did that come from? That was good. I got to remember that. And, you know, I got in trouble again in high school because of my drinking. And, again, I should have been put out of school this time, but I got a sweetheart deal, and they let it go. And there I was. I went to college, and I had a girlfriend my freshman year, and she came to my dorm room one time crying, and she said, I'm really worried about you. Like, what are you talking about? I've been praying about you. Oh, please, don't do that crap, you know? Jesus, really? She goes, yeah, I think you have a problem with alcohol. Like, what are you talking about? Well, when you went to meet my father and mother, I asked you, please don't drink. They're suspicious about you because you're from New Orleans. They think everybody from New Orleans is a bunch of alcoholics. And when I showed up, you had a beer in your hand. First thing you asked my dad is, could he make you a drink? And I had to do a lot of backpedaling and a lot of stuff to convince my parents that you were really a nice guy, that you were just nervous about it. And then she said something to me. She said, you know, I talked to a friend of mine. She just went to treatment. This was 1976. I didn't know what treatment was. It didn't sound good, though. It didn't sound like anything I want to have anything to do with. And she said, you sound a lot like she did before she went to treatment. Well, I was mad that she was talking about me. And then, you know, she cried, and she was telling me she loved me, and she was afraid that something bad was going to happen to me. And all I could hear her say was, you're no good. You're a loser. You're worthless. Because that's what I secretly felt about myself, that I was just no damn good. I didn't make mistakes. I was the mistake. I didn't figure that out later until I started doing inventory work in the program. So I went into bar business in New Orleans. I didn't flunk out of LSU, but my dad told me, I hope you enjoyed it, because now college is on you. So I moved to New Orleans, lived with them, worked in the bar business. And again, you know, I was the kind of guy, like, everybody would be all excited that I was going to start working there. Oh, man, Glenn's coming. Yay, yay, yay. And then a month or two later, they'd be like, no, you hired him. No, you hired him. That was the story of my life. But I'd always get another job. And the thing about in New Orleans particularly, the security details were always off-duty NOPD. So So they would always give me their courtesy cards, because a lot of times I was the guy that paid them. I was the guy that, you know, gave them drinks. I was the guy who gave them dry goods, if you will, to help them stay up, like me. And so they all liked me until I would use their courtesy card, because I got pulled over. And I probably had 8 or 9 incidents where I either got pulled over or I had like a one car kind of scrape and got away. And I never really thought I had a problem with the alcohol. The other thing that's really significant too, they say that it's a progressive disease. What I didn't realize, even though my drinking was still okay in terms of being able to manage my life for the most part, I managed to graduate from high school. I mean, I graduated from college, and I actually held down jobs and whatnot. And then, but I didn't realize I was getting really sick of spirit. And what that meant was there was a stop sign by my house that I tried to run. Well, I ran it every night, and the car I had could only get up to about 85 miles an hour. But I ran it every night at 85 miles an hour. And if you'd have asked me if I was suicidal, I'd have told you no. But I did that every night. And so without me knowing it, and again, this is my life. You would think I would know it, but I wasn't there totally. I had this whole other idea. They tell us that, you know, the alcoholic lives the double life, right? And there was the stuff that was going on, and then there was what was really going on. There was the me I wanted you to see, and there was the me that I didn't want you to see. The me I didn't want you to see was in a lot of pain and feeling really less than inadequate, insecure, afraid, and I didn't like it. I didn't know what to do about it. I knew not to talk about it, not to let it on. I started losing jobs in the bar business in New Orleans, which you can actually do, believe it or not. Because they want you to be on duty. They don't want you, like, drunk, coming in drunk. They don't want you doing drugs, selling drugs. They don't want you off away from your duty station doing God knows what. And eventually, and I had lots of fair warnings about it, but I would wind up getting fired from bar jobs. So I got... That happened to me twice. And one was on Mardi Gras Day, which is really, really hard to do. But I did it. I did it. And I'd have told you that it wasn't because of my behaviors. It wasn't because of my drinking or drugging. It was because the guy who was the general manager was jealous of me. Because his girlfriend told me a lot of times she liked me more than him. And I would tell it to anybody who would listen to it. Again, you know, that double life, what I wanted it to be and what it really was. I had a hard time looking at my end of whatever was going on. I started thinking maybe I do need help. I need help. And, you know, some people, when they need help, they go to a psychiatric hospital and they check in. I went to a psychiatric hospital and I took a job. Big shot, know-it-all drunk. The other thing I have is I've got something I think is part and parcel of my alcoholism. It's called MSU. And it doesn't stand for Michigan State University. It stands for making shit up. And I thought if I went to this hospital, I could figure out what was wrong with me. And then, of course, I would meet the right girl that would make everything fly right. And if you knew, I don't recommend that. I probably went through about 6 of those, and they never got me sober. It just caused a lot of trouble. But anyway, so I went there, and I don't know. I wasn't there very long. And this was 1984. I read a book that was there. Nobody made me read it. I picked it. I looked at it. It wasn't the AA Big Book, but it was a medical doctor talking about the differences between alcoholism and social drinking. And it nailed me to a T. Blackouts, not being able to control how much I drank when I got started, and not being able to stay away from it when I said I would. Not being able to stay away from it when I really wanted to. And those things kind of really hit me hard. And I, by that time, I'd already found that girl, right? And she, I remember telling her, God, I think I'm an alcoholic. And she said, no, I just think you're depressed. Well, there you go. But something about that really made an impression on me. And then I was really trying desperately to control my drinking. And I tried to control my drinking the way the Big Book kind of outlines. I tried to slow down. In other words, I wouldn't drink as much or as often. I tried to swap. I wouldn't drink hard whiskey. I would drink beer or wine. I wouldn't do dry goods. And then I wouldn't... And then that always would blow up. So then I tried stopping altogether. And I could stop for maybe a week or sometimes 2, but eventually wind up with a bigger blow up. And something about reading that thing really made an impression on me. I have not relapsed since my first meeting. Now, that's not because I'm smart or spiritual or anything like that. I think it's just a matter of timing. If I'd have been gone, made to go to meetings early, I could have gone to meetings as early as high school, because I had a lot of trouble with alcohol starting from then. Certainly in college, certainly in the bar business. If I didn't know the people I know, I would have gotten popped for a lot of various things. I'd have had probably a suitcase full of Desire chips. But when it hit me, I had tried everything on my own power I could think of to stop drinking or slow down drinking, and it just wouldn't work. Just wouldn't work. I wound up going back in the bar business with a firm resolve just to drink beer and wine and occasionally schnapps, no drugs, and that lasted 3 months. In 3 months, I was doing stimulants to help me finish out the shift, which led to me drinking hard whiskey, which led for me being me again, and things started falling apart again. And so I met a woman who's actually here today, my ex-wife. She moved back to San Antonio. God bless her. There's a statue for her somewhere in New Orleans. And Linda and I started going out, and in typical kind of alcohol fashion, we started going out like in April, and I was married to her in August to prove to everybody I wasn't a loser. And, you know, then my drinking started showing up in our marriage. And she said, hey, I don't mind you drinking, just don't get drunk. You know, the AA Big Book tells us there's a test in Chapter 3. I don't know if you've ever tried it or know what I'm talking about. You know, step over to the nearest bar room, try some controlled drinking, try to drink and stop abruptly. It will not take long for you to decide if you're honest with yourself. It might be worth a good, it might be worth a bad case of the jitters to get full knowledge of yourself. And I don't really recommend that test. One, it doesn't really work if you're like me, because I'd go to the bar and, like, I'm okay, I'm not going to do anything before I get to the bar. I'm going to have two standard drinks, not two Glen-sized drinks, but two standard drinks. After the second drink, I'm shutting it down, going home. Well, about midway through the second drink, I would start to realize this is a bad test day, right? Woo! I don't know, man. After the first one would hit me and I'd have a few sips, and I said, man, I had the same reaction to alcohol all the time. Boy, that was good. The next one will be better. That was good. The next one will be better. And I knew the next one was going to take me to nirvana. And I always was about that close. But the next one never got me there. But the next one would. And I didn't realize that that's what powerless over alcohol meant, that I couldn't control what happened once I took that first one. I didn't get in trouble, necessarily, but I couldn't control how much I was going to take in. So the other thing, too, I don't really recommend that test because there was a guy in New Orleans who was really, he really hit the bottom hard. But he was a writer, and right when he was about 6 months sober, he got a big royalty check from this book he had submitted in a blackout that he didn't really remember about. And he got a big royalty check, and he decided maybe he'd overreacted. And I think the cops said, had he been, had his girlfriend been wearing a helmet, she would have lived. Had he been wearing a helmet, it would have been an open casket. So there's a big price tag to pay for relapse. And your relapse isn't recommended or suggested. However, if it does happen, really just keep coming back. No one will judge you as harshly as you judge yourself. But, you know, I think it works a lot better if you don't drink in between meetings. That's just my opinion. So anyway, I don't know. Linda and I wound up getting married, and we went to her rabbi for a rabbinical blessing. Like, we went back out to California, and he, man, I don't know, man, he just knew me before before I said a word. He had me sized up. I didn't know. Rabbi Sandy Rosen was not a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but he was a member of Al-Anon, and he asked me some questions. Tricky questions, you know? Like, do you want your marriage to be like your parents? No. Why not? Well, they're both alcoholic. Well, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? Well, no, I don't think so. Ah, but you have questions. What? Well, you didn't just tell me no, I don't, but you say no, I don't think so. See how you tricked me? Because look, I won't say anything. And he was a rabbi, you know, and he said, it's no skin off my nose, and he had a big old schnoz. And he's totally disarmed me with that, and he said, it's no skin off my nose, but if you think you have a problem with alcohol, why don't you go try Alcoholics Anonymous? Now, he's not the first guy that told me that. But for whatever reason, it just kind of burned him. Because here was a guy, you know, he was a really good guy. He was a decent guy, and he wasn't trying to put me down. That was very clear. He was trying to help me. He wanted me to do better with my life. But I left there thinking, that's the last damn place I'll ever be. And I think I went to my first meeting about 12 days later. And, you know, I don't think the 13th is actually my sobriety date, but I couldn't remember, so I picked the 13th because it's easy to remember. And I believe if the AA, the way I read the AA history is right, that's the day that Bill has this kind of white light experience in the town's hospital. It was somewhere December 12th or 13th. So I didn't know that till later, but man, I think that kind of solidified me keeping the 13th as my sobriety date. But I didn't want to go there. I really didn't think I had a problem with alcohol. I don't know why I didn't think I had a problem with alcohol. But I kept thinking I could control it. I was a fall down drunk by the time I got here. I was 29. But I think through all the stimulant use I did, I would drink when everybody else would be blacked out, passed out. And so I hit a bottom, pretty hard bottom, pretty fast. I had full-blown withdrawals in my 20s. I couldn't sleep on the bed because it was full of broken glass. And I couldn't sleep in the sofa because it was full of ants. Now, those were tactile and visual hallucinations. There were no ants or glass. But that's where it was. And the most scary thing about the last time I had withdrawals, it was the 7 worst days of my life. And when I finally kicked, finally got, you know, the end of it, I felt like I could really eat something and keep it down. The first thought I had was, that wasn't that bad. That's the insanity of alcoholism. That wasn't that bad. I just need to be smarter. I need to not drink hard whiskey. I need to stay away from drugs. I need to get a better class of people to hang out with. And this time I'll do it differently. This time, and I don't know, every time I did it just never worked that way, but I kept thinking I could do it. So anyway, when I just came to Alcoholics Anonymous, not because I wanted to stop drinking. I didn't think I had a drinking problem. I had a back problem. My work and my wife at the time were on my back, and I wanted to get them off. I thought I could buy some time by coming. And I called the central office and said, hey, is it really a bunch of old guys that smoke and shake? And if they're calling me, I'm going to leave. Like, they're going to call all the meetings. Hey, this new guy, Glenn's coming to me. Don't call on him. He'll leave. Wow. Just kind of a little self-centered there, a little self-obsessed. Anyway, I went to the first meeting, and I went late because if you're a know-it-all drunk like me, you figure things out fast. And not that they're right, but I figure them out fast. And the way I figured it out was I would go late, leave early, and when people would ask me, what do you think, I would say, well, I don't know. So I went, and there was one chair open in the meeting, and I sat there, and then I realized why nobody else had sat there. This guy looked like he was 99 years old, who was shaking, who had a cigarette in his hand, said, we'll start with this young man right here. And see, like, my track record says, Glenn says, I knew he would do that. I knew they would do it. I knew it would be bullshit like this. And I get up and leave. But for whatever reason, I stayed, and I said, my name is Glenn. This is my first meeting. I think I'm an alcoholic. Now, that was not in my plans. I don't know why I did it. I think it was a miracle. I think all the prayers my mom and my grandmother said for me, like, were come to fruition that day. And so I started talking about, like, not being able to control my drinking anymore. And, you know, the thing is, when you really start hitting the bottom, I made a lot of promises that I meant when I said, but I'd never keep them. So everybody thought I was a liar, and I thought I was crazy. And everybody, I was telling it to people, and people were nodding. They would give me that AA nod. And I thought, wow, they're not putting me out. So I didn't know what they were expecting me, so I kept talking. And a guy said, hey, dude, is this your first meeting? I said, yeah, why? Did I do something wrong? He goes, no, I wish I could have talked at my first meeting. Like, you mean I didn't have to talk? So no, you're doing great. Keep on. And I don't know what else I said, but I stopped talking, and everybody kind of directed the meeting at me. And I'm not long on paying attention for very long. So I looked on the wall and I saw the steps, and I did them my first meeting. In between gawking at women and stuff, you know. And at the very end of the meeting, they gave out chips at the very end of that meeting, and a guy asked me, he said, well, I mean, I guess they asked me if I wanted a desire chip. I wasn't paying attention. I didn't know what it was. And a guy got a 30-day chip, and I asked the guy next to me, what does that mean? He says, well, he hasn't had a drink in 30 days. And I said, bullshit, but I thought I said it to myself. Half the room turned around. I'm kind of a loud guy. And so, I don't know. This guy came up to me and he said, look, I heard what you said, and I don't blame you. I wouldn't believe any of this either. Just be willing to believe that we believe this works. And keep coming back. You'll find us all out to be a bunch of liars, or you'll get 30 days, and it'll make his 30 days easier to believe. And man, you know, like, God, that was so perfect. That was so divinely orchestrated. I couldn't think of anything else that would have made me at least pique an interest. The guy proposed that I could be 30 days sober. And congratulations to the lady that got 30 days. I never thought I'd get 30 days. I never thought I'd get 30 days the same way I never tried to jump off a building and fly. It just seemed impossible. How do you do that? And I don't know. He said that maybe it might be true for me. Now, I'd like to tell you that's why I came to my second meeting. But when I went home, Linda was not exactly pleased I went to an AA meeting, because she really believed, like a lot of Al-Anons do, that, you know, my love for you should be enough to make you stop drinking. And so she didn't want me going to AA. And so to piss her off, I went the next day. But you know, had she told me to go, I wouldn't have gone. And you can ask her today when she's here. She'll tell you she wasn't just gaming me. She really, really believed that. So so in that light, I kept going forward. In the second meeting I went to, a guy said, "Hey, Glenn, it's nice to see you." And I kind of eyeballed him. Like, what does that mean? Because I heard him saying, "What are you doing back here again?" And another guy put his hand on my shoulder and goes, "No, Glenn, I think he's saying it's nice to see you at your second meeting." And yeah, I know. Three times. I would always say I know three times. In fact, I might ever get everybody to say I know three times, but I don't know. We'll see. Anyway, and that's a lot. Oh, man, that was so much me in the beginning of this. But I needed to get sober when I get sober. When I got sober, if you do the math, that was 12 days or so before Christmas, and I needed to get sober at that time because I needed to see it work. I needed to see people stay sober during the holidays. And it seemed to me the meetings got more crowded as we got closer to Christmas. And the club got dressed up. Man, look, where I got sober, the Boulevard Club in New Orleans, this is the Taj Mahal compared to the Boulevard Club. It had like an 8-foot ceiling, and all the meetings were smoking, so there was like a 3-foot cloud of smoke. And that's why they call the meetings anonymous, you know, like, who said that? And I don't know, things were a little different then. Like, there was a lot of crosstalk. In fact, some of the old timers would share over you if they didn't like what you were sharing. Yeah, it was a lot of fun, let me tell you. But I don't know, I kept going back, you know, I kept going back because there was something there I couldn't put my finger on. One, I guess they told me keep coming back, and I wasn't getting a lot of invitations. Like, I worked in the bar business for 10 years in New Orleans, and I wasn't welcomed in most places. I couldn't even drink in my own joint. They told me if I ever went there on my day off, they told the whole staff, the owners wanted to be notified. They were going to come there personally and fire me. And I kind of figured they were going to fire me anyway, so I sat down and talked to them and told them what I was trying to do. And I told them, and these weren't my words, and I don't know where they came from again, but I said, look, I know drinking's a problem, and I'm going to stop. I'm making a wholehearted effort to stop. I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to keep my job here if possible, but if it doesn't work out, I'll walk off a shift before I take a drink again. And I don't know why I said that, but I did. And the owner was a husband and wife. The wife got up, hugged me, and kissed me, and said, "I love you. I'm so glad you're saying this because I was going to fire you next week." And I love you, and I didn't want to fire you, but I was going to. And the husband, who was my drinking and drugging buddy, he was looking at me like, "You traitorous bastard." So that's how I ventured forth, you know, working in the bar business. And, you know, I don't know. They tell me, like, when the spiritual solution, I need a spiritual solution for my illness. And when I'm in it, you know, I don't have to have it per se, but when I'm in it, when I'm actively in it, I'm not sick anymore and I'm not looking for a solution. So me being around alcohol, you know, for me, it was like selling shoes. I really didn't have much interest in it. And I had lots of reasons not to. I had lots of really awful episodes behind the bar because of drinking. It ceased to be fun. So it wasn't that big of a stretch for me at that time not to drink. Now, I still had an alcoholic personality. And that would cause problems because, you know, it's got to be my way. I'm right, you're wrong. I like being right. Anybody else like being right? I like it particularly when I'm right and you're wrong. So then you owe me something. It got pointed out to me that the step one, it said that I was powerless over alcohol. Somebody said, well, do you know what that means? What does powerless mean? Yeah, yeah, I know what it means. It means like, you know, like being powerless and shit. And he pointed that part in the book that said that, you know, what it meant was I'd lost the power of choice when it came to alcohol, meaning when I got started, I didn't know if I would be able to stop, and when I tried to stop, I couldn't always stay stopped. And then this little thing that, you know, if you notice, that's the only place I know that there's a dash anywhere in our big book. It says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, dash. And it was explained to me that the dash meant end of previous thought, begin new thought, that our lives had become unmanageable. And it was explained to me that that meant that when I'm not drinking, my life becomes unmanageable. And boy, that was so true for me. Because see, alcohol wasn't my problem. It was my solution. That was my answer. Because, I don't know, I wasn't like... Sober says we're restless, irritable, and discontented unless we can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. I think I was that way before I ever drank. And then it worked for a while. But then towards the end, man, I needed a drink more and more often to just deal with good news, bad news, and no news. And so they said that, you know, my life was unmanageable, like abstinence was what was unmanageable for me, not drinking. And I never really thought of it that way, but that made a lot of sense. Getting sober around Christmas was really a great idea for me because I don't know. I just never thought it was possible. I thought there'd be a bunch of long, mopey faces, you know, like, oh, man, I can't drink. It's Christmas. There was nothing like that. People were dressed up and in a good mood. And I don't know. You know, you can't shit a bullshitter, right? Yeah. And I knew they were telling the truth. And I thought there'd be a lot of people relapsing. And actually, one poor guy did relapse right before Christmas. And I didn't even know what that meant. And I asked one of the old timers, I said, what is it? So-and-so, they said, so-and-so relapsed. They were all talking about it in the parking lot. So what does that mean? And he said, well, you know, what is a relapse? He goes, you can't have one to begin with. And secondly, it means he drank again. And I figured, oh, good, now we're going to see the real AA, right? I figured they're going to throw this poor son bitch in the middle and everybody's going to fire on him and call him names and give him a hard time. And all they did was they gave him a new desire chip and everybody clapped and hugged him and asked him to keep coming back. And that really made a big impression on me. And so, you know, the other thing was, I think, right before Christmas, I asked one of the old timers, I said, are y'all going to have a meeting on Christmas Day? Are y'all going to have meetings here on Christmas Day? And he said, boy, did you drink whiskey on Christmas Day? I have. Yes, sir. He goes, well, we have meetings on Christmas Day, so get here early. It gets crowded. And like, what? And so, you know, if you've never been to Club 12 during the holidays, man, please make use of this place because we have those 6 days or 7 days of Christmas where we provide a meal, serving, you know, being here, being around other people, cleaning up. Man, it works in a pinch. It really does. If Christmas is a hard time for you, if you really don't think you can be sober through it, it's a great time to be here. It truly is. I wouldn't trade any of my Christmas experiences for the world, like being sober. I have always had really great experiences during the holidays simply because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hated Christmas. You know, I absolutely hated it. There were a lot of times I'd be in a bar by myself with me and the barmaid and another guy or another person, and nobody wanted to be there. And, you know, and the reason was it wasn't I didn't like where I was. I didn't like the company I was keeping, meaning me. And the spiritual solution as they lay it out for me here is that I'm going to get in a different relationship with myself via this power greater than myself. I think the hardest concepts for me really were, one was the first word of the 12 steps, is we. I don't need we. I don't like to ask for help. I don't like to depend on people for anything. That's a sucker's game. Asking people to help you is a good way to get disappointed or to owe people. So it was really hard. I mean, there's a whole lot of me between you and me that keeps me from we. And there's a whole lot of me between me and my higher power that keeps me from we. So that's what my alcoholic ego wants to tell me, that I don't need anybody. I got this on my own. I don't need any help. I'll figure this out. Helps the suckers. You know, asking people for help's a sucker's game. And anyway, I didn't realize that that was based on all this fear. I heard a speaker one time say that fear is the muscle of my ego. And if that's true, man, my fear muscle has been exercised a lot. My fear muscle is very strong. And I like my fear so much, not by choice, but just by practice, that I like to make my fears come true. I don't do that on purpose, but I like to figure out how things are going to turn out wrong and walk with that. Like, yeah, I knew it would turn out that way. I knew that. I knew it wouldn't work. I knew. And then, you know, there's some comfort in saying, well, I guess you saw that coming. Like crazy, but that's my ego, and my ego keeps me from like being connected. So like if fear is the muscle of my ego, the weapon of my ego is my opinion, and I can burn my life down on the ground, either sober or not, you know, through my actions. And I can come in here begging, please, please, please help me. I'll do anything. Please, 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 I'll do anything. And about 2 weeks later, no, that's not the help I need. And I got an opinion about you and what you're all about. Comes back that fast. You know, Dr. Tebow wrote this treatise about the amazing recuperative powers of the alcoholic ego. And for me, man, that's been so true. And then, too, this other one, William James, in his Variety of Spiritual Experiences, says that there are a lot of people who have spiritual experiences and yet drink again. And I had one of those early on before I ever went to AA. I was at a Christmas party, and I became like, from the happy-go-lucky life of the party, I became like the oh shit guy, like, you know, oh shit, Glenn's here. Oh shit, who invited him? Oh shit, is he drinking again? And at that point in my drinking, I became like a crying drunk. And I was supposed to be Santa Claus at this party. So here I am, drunk, crying Santa, and all my friends are like, oh, Glenn, what's wrong? What can we do? Like, and if I was in a bar, I would tell them, leave me alone. If you ask me again, I'll punch you right in the mouth. That's the guy you want to party with, right? But, you know, these were nice people. They weren't like bar people, so I would just, I don't know. I don't know what you can do. And one of the guys there, I didn't really know that well, he said, I know what's wrong with you. You don't remember me that much, but I went to LSU with you. You know, you're an alcoholic. You're a drug addict. And this is probably a year before I ever went to AA. He goes, look, I've been going to church, and I've been saved, and I'm not an alcoholic or drug addict anymore. If you want me to, I'll pray over you. Like, I'm out of ideas, dude. Whatever. And I figured if I get him out of there, I could have another drink, right? So he prayed over me, and you know what? I felt something. Something did change. I quit crying. I didn't want another drink. I was able to do Santa Claus. And so I'm feeling pretty good. And when he's leaving the party, he shakes my hand and he gives me a hug. He says, okay, when I call you tomorrow for church, don't pretend like this shit didn't happen. Oh, shit, he was going to want me to go to church with him now. Just that fast. Just that fast. I, you know, just couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. I wasn't crushed enough by the self-imposed juggernaut of self-will yet, so I could, like, accept any kind of spiritual help. You know, the book has a line in there. It says, to accept spiritual help or live or die an alcoholic death are not always easy alternatives. And I don't know if he's trying to be funny or not, but I don't know if you've ever seen anybody die an alcoholic death. I don't know what's sadder is that everyone I love and want their approval hate me and can't wait for my demise, or that I hate me more than they hate me because the one thing that worked in my life isn't working anymore, that there's truly no friendly direction anymore. Alcohol quit working. There's no place to go, nothing. And so my choice is to die that death. And it's a slow death, man. I heard a speaker say it's like getting kicked to death by rabbits. It takes a long time, man. Even when you're in full-blown cirrhosis of the liver, even when you're wet brain, you know, it takes a long time to die, man. I've seen people that I think the kinder thing would have been had they would die would be the kinder thing. But you can't kill them with a stick. They won't die, you know. And they keep going on, and just their day's a little bit worse each and every day. Because people used to tell me, like, man, if you keep doing what you're going to do, you're going to die. And I'd say, good, when? And I don't think I was just trying to put them off. I mean, but I was close to that. My spirit was pretty much dead when I got here. Anyway, so this thing about this spiritual life, and in Bill's story, he says that we have to enlarge our spiritual life. And you would think it would be by prayer and reading, you know, inspirational literature. But it's not. It's by constant thought and work of others. Constant thought and work of others. And I don't know how a guy like Bill Wilson, he was a big shot know-it-all drunk, was all about himself. I don't know how he comes up with that. I mean, that is truly divinely inspired. And that's been my experience too. There's a story in the third chapter, more about alcoholism. One of my favorite guys in there, his name is Jim, but we like to call him Milky Jim, right? He's the guy who put whiskey in milk. But before he goes to the bar and puts whiskey in the milk, he says he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. And I think the biggest byproduct of working with others is I get gratitude. And I thought for a long time that Alcoholics Anonymous, like, you would be sober, get sober, and then you would show your gratitude by helping others. And it sounds right, but at least in my experience, it's wrong. I get gratitude by working with others. Something about them looking to me, for example, does something to my spirit. Something about me being to help people when they really need help does something for my spirit I cannot do by myself. It's a wonderful proposition that, you know, there are times where I'm really not that smart. I tell things to sponsees, and I don't know where it came from, but it didn't come from me. Because I'm really not that smart. And like, wow. And I'll tell them, hey, man, let me know if that works, because I'm going to try it myself. And, you know, like, sometimes, I get to this point where I think I know all this stuff, and then somebody asks me something. I said, well, let's see what the book says. And we go through what the book says, and I'm like, God, I need to get back on that myself, you know. And something about working with newcomers, you know, just does that for me. And it gets me in this place of gratitude. I think the thing that happens, too, is I think I take things for granted real easily. That's another thing that happens with my alcoholic ego. Working with newcomers keeps the things that I'm grateful for pretty green. Because I hear them being grateful for stuff that I've taken for granted. And that's always a real blessing for me. It helps me to see things in perspective. When I was about 4 years sober, I was working with a new sponsor, and he was really, really big on gratitude. And he told me, like, he was kind of tired of hearing me complaining and whining about my job, my this, my that, whatever. And because, you know, nobody was doing it right. That's the first sign that I'm spiritually sick, when nobody's doing it right. That means I'm off the beam. People in meetings weren't doing it right. They weren't into the book. People weren't, you know. So he said, you ought to bring a meeting to there's a place in New Orleans called the Bridge House. And the Bridge House was literally a long-term residential place for low-bottom guys. It was literally underneath the bridge. And I went there, and I thought I would see these guys and everything they went through, and I thought I would say, wow, I'm grateful that didn't happen to me. But something different happened. I'd hear these guys being grateful for stuff that I was taking for granted. I was particularly bitching a lot about my job, and there was a guy there. I was in my 30s, and there was a guy that was about my age now. And he was saying, man, I'm so excited I get to go back to work on Monday. He said, you know, I've been unemployed for 11 years. I've been unemployable for about 4. And I get to go back to work on Monday. Jeez, man. He goes, you know, it's a temp job with a day labor pool, but I'm just so excited. It's going to feel so good to be back at work. He goes, God, I hope I can sleep on Sunday. And something about that man sitting, like, from where me and Paul are, just really hit me. Now, I didn't stop complaining about my job, but it was different. And then shortly thereafter, I really started. I mean, the words that really stood out to me, he said, I get to go to work. And that's the thing I really try to remember. Like, all these things I think I have to do is I get to do. Because just this past summer, my roommate, who was a year younger than I am, and he was a really nice guy. He was a nice drunk. He wasn't like me. I was a mean, kind of surly, nasty, ugly drunk towards the end. He died of alcoholism. I took him to meetings. He really didn't think he needed it. And he had gotten sober through a woman that he started living with. And she had a stroke, and the family thought he was a freeloader. They put him out. He went back to live in his mom's house. A friend of his thought it'd be a good idea to talk him into drinking again, and he drank. And within a couple of weeks, he had esophageal hemorrhage and died. That could be me. You know, that could be me. If I drink again, none of this is possible. And today, it's important for me to remember that I have luxury problems. And that, like, I have problems in areas I didn't have areas in before, right? Job, taxes, retirement, those types of things. Yeah, you know, like, I don't know. A lot of the guys I drank with are dead, or in the joint, or they're in witness protection program somewhere. I never heard from them again. And so I'm, like, really, really fortunate. I get really stoked up, too, to see folks, the younger folks come in. It really does me good to see young people come in here. And we have a really great contingent of young people. And I know some of the people, when they were young, maybe they're not so young now. That's kind of cool, too, that they stayed sober. I'll share one last thing about gratitude that really means a lot to me. One of my favorite guys in New Orleans was a guy named, well, his name's Gary, but we called him Cash because he was a bank robber. And Cash did 35 years in San Quentin. Cash was shaved head. I guess he had been pretty muscular at one time in his life, but he was on in years. And he was covered, he was suited out in ink. Not like the nice fashion ink you see today. This is bad prison ink. And he got hep C, cirrhosis of the liver, and liver cancer from all the dirty needles in the joint. And when he got out, he continued to use, but he found out his daughter was using. So he stopped, and he started going to AA. And he was sober a while. And one day I saw him, it was a hot July day in New Orleans. I saw him taking the bus. I was like, Cash, man, what are you doing? Get in the car. And he's like, no, man, I'm cool. I'm like, come on, man, it's 1,000 degrees out here. Get in the car, I'll give you a ride. He goes, you know what, man? Well, you can get on and off the bus when you want, and when you get on the bus, they don't shackle you to the floor. I kind of like the bus. Like, shit, what do you say, you know? And then one day at a meeting, he said, every day's a holiday, every meal's a feast. He goes, I'm the luckiest guy in the world. He goes, I live in a public housing unit that's really close to the bus line. The bus line's close to all my doctors. I have great doctors, and they're really helping me. They give me a lot of hope. He goes, but the best part about the public housing unit I live in, there's a lot of old people there, and they ask me to help them. It's like, dude, look at me. I'm the guy everybody ran from. And he said, you know, man, it feels so good to be able to be of service to people. It really does. And I would always think, man, do we all have to do 35 years in the joint to really, like, lock into gratitude the way he does? So I think that's about time. I'm really grateful to be here. Thank you, guys. Blessings to y'all for Christmas.